For their support, they're a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. It's 6 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
More troops are on their way to Washington, D.C. now after two members of the National Guard were shot near the White House this afternoon.
And Ursa Minor. The teddy bear's mind was presumably blank when a bunch of British students launched him into the stratosphere for a science project, so we'll never know why he ejected himself from 90,000 feet up, even if they can locate him and ask him, which is what they are now trying desperately to do.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
It is a minute after 6 o'clock, and you are tuned in to People Powered KEXE. More news from Canada coming up next. It's As It Happens. KEXE has built connections between listeners, community organizations, and local businesses in northern Minnesota since 1976. Consider becoming a business or community sponsor to help KEXE build strong connections now and into the future. You can text the word sponsor to 218-326-1234. We receive support from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji. They provide full-service interior painting in residential locations throughout northern Minnesota, offering custom kitchen cabinet refinishing as well as one-room or whole-house repainting. More information at borealbrushworkspainting.com. Got a lot going on in our region, including tomorrow, as many communities are coming together to provide free Thanksgiving meals. That includes Floodwood, the New Life Community Church. Their meal is at 12 p.m. tomorrow. Grand Rapids Centennial Rotary Club offer a free Thanksgiving meal tomorrow from 11 to 1 o'clock. That one is at St. Joseph Catholic Church. And Triumphant Life Church in Bovee hosts the 17th annual free Thanksgiving community meal tomorrow from 11 to 5 o'clock. You can also find a community meal at Pequot Lakes tomorrow, a free will dinner from 11 to 3 at the American Legion Post 49. Let's take a listen now to our album of the week. It's by Silvana Estrada.
Si te vas o si te quedas, dime si es de veras esta vez. Dime qué vamos a hacer ahora, falsos simulacros en la piel. ¿Cuál era la idea de aventarte sin dejarte caer? ¿Qué manera tan desoladora de querer? Solo la hora de querer.
Neil Kirksall.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Shots and shock. The White House went into lockdown this afternoon after two members of the National Guard were shot in Washington. We'll get the latest from the U.S. Capitol.
Towering inferno. A reporter in Hong Kong describes the catastrophic scene after a fire rips through high-rise apartment towers, killing dozens, including a firefighter.
Fundamental funds. A huge donation to a Toronto hospital will finance new research that could change the way we screen for cancer. We'll speak with a scientist who hopes that one day doctors will be able to diagnose early-stage cancer with one simple blood test.
Sparing no expenses. The UK's fiscal watchdog accidentally scoops the government by releasing the budget an hour early, causing chaos on trading floors and catcalls in Parliament.
Zero love. A dispute over tennis courts in Palm Beach, Florida, morphed into a tale of hate mail, stolen DNA, and now, 15 years later, a civil suit decision worth $50 million US.
And bear in mind, a group of British students are asking for the public's help to find a lost toy bear after he took a tumble from a great height, specifically the stratosphere, where they sent him on a balloon. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that figures sending stuffed toys to space has its pluses and minuses. Their deployment to the streets of Washington, D.C. was controversial from the start, possibly even illegal. And now two members of the National Guard have been shot in the U.S. Capitol. As we go to air tonight, they're in critical condition. We also don't know the identity of the shooter, who is in police custody. But this afternoon, the shooting shocked the city, put the White House under lockdown, and grounded flights at Ronald Reagan National Airport. Paul Hunter is the CBC's senior Washington correspondent. That's where we reached him earlier today.
Paul, can you just situate for our listeners where in D.C. this happened?
Right in the heart of D.C. I mean, we're about 5 minutes, we have the CBC Bureau, 5 minutes from the White House east. This is about 5 minutes northwest, a couple of blocks maybe. The White House, you know, 1600 Pennsylvania, this on 17th. It steps from the White House. Farragut Square, it's office buildings, restaurants, coffee shops, that kind of thing. The subway station where this happened, normally supremely busy on a sort of rush hour afternoon. But this is a very quiet day in D.C. today. Tomorrow's U.S. Thanksgiving. The city's basically emptied out. I walked to work. The sidewalks were empty today, save for a few National Guards, men and women who you see all the time now out as they were today. But it basically is right in the heart of D.C. Yeah. And just, as I say, steps from the White House.
One of our producers spoke with the owner of a restaurant nearby where all of this happened and said the same thing. But given the time of year it is, Thanksgiving coming up, things are very quiet still, no less unsettling for those who are there. The fact that the National Guard is in the city, obviously we've talked a lot on this show and you've been reporting on, you know, the controversies around those deployments across the country. It's unusual that they're in D.C. as well. Remind us of how they got there, why they're there right now.
Yeah, and it's very contentious still. I mean, this is Donald Trump using the power of the presidency to reshape aspects of America. And there are many who cheer him on this and many who do not. But back in August, Trump declared a crime emergency in Washington, D.C. And next thing you know, you saw National Guards men and Guards women everywhere. I think about 800 of them were sent here, 200 on any given day out on the streets, walking, talking. You know, to be honest about it, it often looks like they're just killing time. Because, you know, I mean, D.C. is not the safest place on the planet, but you know, it hit the crime in this city hit a 30-year low last year, and what you see with the National Guard people on the street. They're walking past people sitting in outdoor cafes and people just walking in and out of shops and in a carefree manner. It's kind of a bizarre thing. I part of me has felt sorry for them because, like, I wonder if I'm them, what would I be thinking I need to do? But nonetheless, they're here because of Donald Trump. He sent them here, and so they came. Trump later, quite publicly, saying, "You know, D.C. is now safe again. National Guard did its job, but there they are still out on the streets."
And is it true that the deployment was set to end soon, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I think it's been extended. Some, I think, were set to leave the end of this month, but the broadly speaking, it's through to February of next year. And again, some of them are from D.C. and some of them have come from other states. I think some of the ones coming from some of the other states were set to leave. But nonetheless, you see them all the time, and they're armed, right? A lot of them have been deputized, so you see the side guns on them. It's not unsettling, but it's just weird, and has been throughout the whole time.
It's still early in the investigation, obviously, as we speak, just before our show goes to air. Not long ago, FBI Director Kash Patel, the mayor of D.C., and other officials were speaking out about this, giving a news conference, talking about the investigation that is to come and what they know so far, saying they believe this was targeted. What are you expecting? I mean, it's usually a quiet couple of days around Thanksgiving, obviously. This is not what's normally unfolding. But what do you think politically is going to be the domino effect of this in the next few days?
That's a tough one, right? Because we don't know what led this person to do this. Is it like a mental health thing, or is it a political? I mean, it seems that they were targeted. There has been broad antipathy toward the National Guard in D.C. D.C. is not a city that is full of Trump fans broadly. It is a very democratic city. This is America, and there are a lot of guns in this country, famously. Was this a one-off? Was it political? It's, you know, steps from the White House, but it wasn't at the White House. So you can see the White House down the street from this station, but nobody really knows what's behind it. That's the problem. So how will Donald Trump respond? Will he extend them further? Will he bring more troops to the streets of D.C.? Is this will this be considered domestic terrorism? What are we in for in this city, I think, is the question that comes out of it. I mean, a lot of people, I think, in this country were waiting for something like this to happen with the National Guard troops being everywhere. And now here we are. And I don't know where this goes from here, but it doesn't feel like it's going to go to anything that's going to end up in a good place.
Paul, I appreciate this as always. Thank you. Please take care.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Hunter is the CBC's senior Washington correspondent. We reached him in Washington, D.C. earlier today. Hundreds of people across Canada are diagnosed with cancer every day, many of them too late. Now a team of doctors and researchers is hoping to change that, and they have the funds to try. Billionaire housing magnate Peter Gilgan is donating $50 million to the Princess Margaret Cancer Foundation in Toronto. That money will establish a new early detection research program that's being billed as the largest of its kind in the world. Trevor Pugh is a cancer genomics researcher and senior scientist at the Princess Margaret, who will be leading research in the new program. We reached him in Toronto.
Trevor, we hear about big donations and endowments in this field a lot, but this is a considerable amount of money, $50 million. How far could it go in cancer research, that kind of money?
This type of gift really transforms and kickstarts the type of work that we're doing at the Princess Margaret. What we might contemplate doing 5 or 10 years from now we're literally going to start next year. And that's really the accelerating effect of large gifts like this.
And time is certainly crucial when we're talking about these kinds of illnesses, and you know better than many people. How did you come to the decision, or how did the team come to the decision that this kind of project, the goal is to detect cancer at the earliest possible stage? How was that chosen? Why was it chosen as the best way to spend this money?
Yeah, time, just like you said, time is the most important thing. And what we want to do is change how and at what time point we're detecting cancer. We want to start talking about stage one, maybe even stage zero cancers, when this disease is the most treatable. So the earlier you can catch cancer, the more treatments you have available and the more effective you are. And you can really start to think about terms like cure, which are very difficult at the later stages.
Far too many people, wherever they're listening from, are familiar with these diseases, the screening process, and how important time is, as you said. But for people who may not know, what is the problem you're trying to solve with how the current typical screening process or detection process might work now here?
Yeah, there's several problems we're trying to tackle. One of them is sensitivity. How do we find cancer at its earliest possible stage? The other question is, where is it? It's one thing to say, we found cancer. In our case, we're looking at blood testing for finding early disease. But where is it in the body? And then the third question, once you found cancer, what are you going to do about it? So there's in this specific program that's being funded, there's a strong focus on clinical trials and intervening once cancer is found in the blood.
You know as well that there's a lot of debate about which cancers have the most, you know, research has the most funding, which types of cancers, and others would like to see other types of cancer get more attention. Which kinds of cancer will this project help screen for earlier?
That's what makes this type of research so interesting, is it covers literally every possible cancer type. Our focus on developing a better blood test for cancer means that if that cancer is shedding DNA into the bloodstream or potentially other fluids, there's the opportunity to find it. So this truly is, the term we'll often use in the field is pan-cancer. It's really having one singular approach that is relevant to all cancer types. And that makes it a little bit different from maybe some of the other targeted funding that we've received.
And is blood tests, is that where you're focusing the attention? That's where you'll be able to find those early detection markers that have been hiding?
That's where we're focusing now, because we have a track record in this area. And actually, many research groups across the country are really skilled at finding cell-free DNA, or this DNA that's free-floating in the blood. But that doesn't mean it has to be the only biofluid. So we have some groups that are very interested in cell-free DNA in urine, so potential to find bladder cancer or other cancers that may be more readily found in other places.
This gives you an opportunity. I mean, you're scientists, obviously, you're researchers, sober-minded, fact-based, obviously, but have you been allowing yourself to dream about what could come out of this work?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard not to. I also don't want to overpromise, but I really can imagine a day where we'd have an annual blood test. So you go in for your annual checkup and a tube of blood could be taken and we would screen that for all manner of cancer. We have some other protocols, especially for people who are at very high risk for cancer, who are already donating blood every 4 months as part of a surveillance research study. So that's the type of research where it would inform how often do we have to test and can we find all cancers equally? What will probably happen, we'll probably get very good at finding some types of cancers with annual tests, but maybe some other cancers with more frequent testing.
The fact that this is happening here in Canada, what does that signal and mean to you as a researcher here?
Yeah, Canada is an absolute hotbed for exactly this type of research. And it's because there's such acceleration in genomics, which is DNA sequencing, AI and machine learning, so making sense of a lot of this data, and just fundamental genetics. A lot of fundamental genetic and cancer research has actually all been done here in Canada, and this gift is really going to bring all those areas of strength together in one program.
I know you don't want to overpromise, and we don't want you to either, but when you talk about a day where you imagine that we could have these tests regularly, how quickly, how soon could that happen realistically?
the pace of research is just getting faster and faster. Mm-hmm. And what used to take 5 or 10 years is now taking months. This particular gift is over a 5-year period. We want to deliver on that kind of time frame.
Trevor, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you for the opportunity. We're really excited about this donation.
Trevor Pugh is a senior scientist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center and the director of genomics at the Ontario Institute for Cancer Research. We reached him in Toronto. On the day a government announces its budget, there are often little tidbits that get released early, sometimes on purpose or sometimes because an intrepid journalist is doing their job. But it's rare for a government to scoop itself. And yet, that is what happened in the UK today. This morning, the Office for Budget Responsibility accidentally released the details of the budget an hour early, causing a frenzy on the trading floors and anger and mockery in Parliament.
This just looks like a government that is a slow motion car crash. Yeah. His cabinet are briefing against each other. His MPs are planning for life after him. And the most chaotic run up to a budget in recent memory is happening on his watch. Even the chief whip is telling MPs that he wants out. The truth is simple, Mr. Speaker. His MPs don't trust him, the markets don't trust him, and the public certainly don't trust him. When will he finally accept that the chaos starts and ends with him?
Yeah! The most chaotic budget was the Liz Truss budget. It did huge damage to our country. We're still suffering from that damage. But what did she say about Liz Truss? She obviously does still think it. When asked, was Liz Truss right? 100% right, she said. The most chaotic, damaging budget there's ever been. And she sticks by it. I'm very interested to see her response to this budget, if she thinks Liz Truss got it right. Mr. Speaker, what we're doing is focusing on cutting waiting lists, cutting the national debt, cutting the cost of living, renewing our country, a Labour budget with Labour values, delivering for the British people.
UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer answering a question from opposition leader Kemi Badenoch in Parliament today. Bradfield and Bill went on the trip of a lifetime. A couple of weeks ago, they set off from Lymington, Hampshire in a high-altitude weather balloon. It's part of a science project at Walhampton School. A group of 7th and 8th grade students waved and waved as the pair soared into the sky. You'll probably be relieved to hear that Bradfield and Bill are not human children. They're a bear and a badger, respectively. They're stuffed toys. And they're stellar astronauts, since they don't need oxygen. But even though they're inanimate, the students are pretty concerned about them today, because when the balloon came back down, they were no longer on it. Ellie Robinson is a teacher at Walhampton School. She planned the project, and we reached her in Southampton.
Ellie, this has to be upsetting for the students. How is the search going?
Well, we haven't heard anything yet. The children keep asking me if I've heard anything about the bear and have I found him yet. We have been quite honest. It's quite a stretch that we'll find him, because obviously he could have landed in a huge area. But as we've said to them, it's not impossible. So we haven't given up hope.
Okay, so this is a learning experience for them in so many different ways. If we go back to, you know, the balloon goes up, there's excitement and cheers, but when it returns, clearly these space travelers have not, you know, had exactly the kind of trip you were all hoping for. And I know the balloon was equipped with a camera. When you started looking at that with the students, how did they react?
When they saw the moment that the bear slipped off his perch, there was quite a gasp from all the students.
Oh, no.
They were quite shocked. I did have to reassure them that the bear would be fine. And we had some University of Southampton students there as well to explain the science. And they said that he would have actually landed quite safely, even though it was from 90,000 feet. And that the children, I think, were reassured by that. And they're just hoping that maybe someone might find him and send him back to us.
Well, as the word gets out, yes, that's hopefully people will keep an eye out and help Bradfield get back to you. What about Bill?
Well, I'm more hopeful about him finding his way home because he's got a University of Southampton jumper on, so it's quite clear where he's from. So hopefully he'll be making his way back at some point.
And so your school put out a bit of a cheeky video about this expedition, and it's amazing that you had this footage. So it's quite incredible to watch this. It almost doesn't look real. This bear on this journey, but then things take the turn. Can you describe what that video shows for our listeners who haven't seen it? Because it's quite something.
Watching the footage back, it's brilliant because we can see the school below us. The camera pans around because he quite helpfully spins a bit. And so we can see our surrounding area and the sea and everything. And as he goes through the clouds, it gets quite misty and foggy. And then you get this incredible view of when he comes above the clouds. You've got the sun in the background. And he's sort of spinning around above the clouds. You can see the curvature of the earth. Then it gets a bit bumpy. Then it's quite stressful to watch because he's got frost on him and he's bumping around and spinning. And he then unfortunately slips, turns upside down, and you can see his little paws.
Oh.
And then he just slides off and disappears.
Yeah, it's hard to hear and certainly hard to see, I'm sure, for you and the students. But, I mean, is it a bit optimistic to imagine that Bradfield is actually in good shape at this stage, wherever he may be?
I mean, who knows? I'd love to hope for a little Christmas miracle.
Yeah.
He obviously could be outside, you know, anywhere. Maybe someone's picked him up. We don't know.
The logistics involved in getting this off the ground. Can you tell our listeners about what you and the students had to do? Because there's lessons in all of that also.
Yeah, so it was more complicated than I anticipated. I enlisted the help of some university students from Southampton University Space Flight Society. And they were able to help me know what equipment to buy and things like that. And they helped the children to set up the payload, and they taught them all about how it needed to be and make it visible to aircraft and things like that. I had to get permission from the Civil Aviation Authority. And then on the day, I had to ring three different airports to talk to air traffic control. And actually just finding the day was quite tricky because we are quite near the sea. If the wind was going in the wrong direction, it would take the bears straight out to sea, and then we'd never get our equipment back and we wouldn't get any footage. So we had simulations running that kind of put in the weather data and told us where they might end up. And we had to wait for the day where it seemed to be going in the right direction and over land rather than sea.
So you're putting this call out to the public, asking for people to keep an eye out. Are they equipped with trackers as well? I mean, can you pinpoint a general area even at this point?
So unfortunately, the only tracker was with the camera in the balloon, not attached to the bear. So we know that he travels in a pretty much straight line from Lymington up to High Wycombe, which is about a 2-hour journey that he made it in, about 90 miles. So somewhere along that route. But no, he doesn't have a tracker. He's just got a little tag with our school name on.
So you'll keep us posted, Ellie, about what happens with Bradfield and Bill, certainly. But do you have plans for the students to do another project? What's on the go?
I've got some ideas about next next year, and I'm sure there'll be things before then as well. But no, I'm not going to reveal any plans yet because it's always got to be a surprise.
Yes. Ellie, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Ellie Robinson is a teacher at Walhampton School. She's in Southampton.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a timeless flight. Touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh no, 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 I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out his fuse out there with home. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again. Place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them. If you did, and all the science, I don't understand. Just my job 5 days a week. A rocket man, a rocket man. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man.
Elton John with Rocket Man.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a reporter in Hong Kong tells us what she saw at the scene of that deadly fire that tore through several high-rise towers.
And the bizarre tale of a 15-year feud over a tennis court between neighbors and a luxury community in Florida that has ended in a $50 million U.S. judgment. Although, really, there are no winners. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I think it's gonna be a and I think it's gonna be a long, long time.
We're listening to As It Happens, the news from Canada here on People Powered KEXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Hope you're having a good night, that you are staying safe on the roads or warm inside by a fire. Thanksgiving is tomorrow. We've got some great programming for you. We've got some great programming tonight coming up at 7 o'clock. Alyssa Ellen is your host for On the River. Programming tonight is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with the Good Relatives Collaborative to announce the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, the Minneapolis Indian Center, Mokoshe Agricultural Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. More online at goodrelativescollaborative.org. Weather around our region, it is a blustery sort of night with winds out of the northwest, 10 to 25, and lows overnight from 17 to 22. Tomorrow, more winds out of the northwest. We're looking at temperatures in the low to mid-20s.
In Hong Kong this morning, people are waking up from a nightmare. Less than 24 hours ago, the sky there was glowing orange as a massive fire tore through several high-rise apartment towers in the Tai Po district, sending thick black smoke into the air. As we go to air, at least 40 people are confirmed dead, including a firefighter, one of more than 700 who've been battling the flames around the clock, and almost 300 people have been reported missing. Local media are now reporting that police in Hong Kong have arrested three men on suspicion of manslaughter. Laura Westbrook is a freelance journalist based in Hong Kong. That's where we reached her.
Laura, can you describe what you saw when you first arrived at the scene? Because certainly the videos and photographs we're seeing from here are staggering. But what did you see when you first got there?
Yeah, it really did take me by surprise when I arrived on the scene. These buildings, they're around 30 stories high. Eight of these tower blocks were on fire. This housing estate is in the northern part of Hong Kong, and this housing estate had been undergoing renovations, and so there were bamboo scaffolding as well as green mesh covering the outside of these like high-rise mm-hmm. buildings. And according to some of the footage that I was sent by someone at the scene who arrived earlier than me, it showed that the fire spread very, very quickly across the buildings through the bamboo scaffolding, and you know, when I was there, you could hear these pops or these bangs as the debris fell to the ground. And I've been there for many hours, and the firefighters have really been battling to try to get the fire under control. As I was leaving, you could see that the fire was still burning inside the flats of those buildings, with firefighters still trying to get it under control.
And at least one, at this, as we speak, at least one of the people who were killed is a firefighter. That is just one, you know, one more example of why the scene was so dangerous. You mentioned the scaffolding and the renovations. I've been reading that there were plans afoot to phase out bamboo scaffolding in the future because of safety concerns.
Yes, bamboo scaffolding is very, very common in Hong Kong. It's been around reportedly for hundreds of years. And there, the government is trying to phase it out, and so when you have fire of this scale, it's still worth saying that it is unclear what the cause of the fire is. But having seen that footage on social media, you could see it spreading, not just through the bamboo scaffolding, but also this green mesh sort of netting that was on the outside of the buildings as well.
And in terms of the neighborhood itself, the some 4,800 people who live in these thousands of apartments you were describing in those eight tower blocks, what is this neighborhood like? Who are the people that live there?
Yeah, this is a district in the northern part of the city, and in the New Territories. It's home to luxury housing blocks as well as public housing estates. It's a bit more of a suburban area of the city. It's very green. And when I was there, it did seem like a very close-knit community. There were many, many people still at the scene watching the blaze, watching the firefighters, trying to get it under control. People, also there handing out water to us journalists who were doing our lives.
And you know, many of the residents in Hong Kong, they live in multi-generational flats. So it's quite common for flats to have, you know, one, two, three generations of people living there.
Were you able to speak? I know journalists, you know, as journalists, we're kept a safe distance away from these kinds of scenes as firefighters and emergency crews do their work. But for the people who were able to get out and get to safety, have you heard any of their stories? Have you spoken to them at all?
Well, there was one man who was standing next to me. He said that he was a resident of the building and he had been there for about 3 hours at one point. I guess, you know, he didn't really know where to go, and it must be so heartbreaking to watch your home burn. You know, I'd be very surprised if any of those homes had any of their possessions left. This fire was a level 5 fire. That is the highest level fire in Hong Kong. The last time there was a fire of this scale was decades ago. And so this is a, you know, very serious fire. And for the authorities have opened shelters for the residents who've been displaced. Many of them reportedly sleeping in shelters in primary schools as well as sports centers overnight as this fire continues to burn.
And what's your sense, Laura, of, I mean, was this something that people in the area were worried about? It's been so long, as you said, that since there's been a level 5 fire like this, such a deadly fire. Was this top of mind for people?
Well, I think it did take, you know, it certainly took me by surprise. But the city's local forecaster, it did say that it had put out a red fire warning since Monday, and that means that there are conditions for severe fires. So that is something that had been put out by forecasters. But really, the scale of the fire, how quickly it spreads, and how difficult it's been to get it under control. These are all questions that I'm certainly asking, and I know some of the residents, according to media reports, are also asking. One of the authorities have also said that, you know, it is dark right now, so the it being dark is also hampering efforts as well to try to get this blaze under control.
Laura, I appreciate this. Please take care.
Thank you.
Laura Westbrook is a freelance journalist based in Hong Kong, and that's where we reached her earlier today. It's been over a month now since the British Columbia community of Dawson Creek declared a state of local emergency because of severe and prolonged drought in the area. At the time, the city said conditions had significantly reduced the available water supply. And today, with winter approaching, there are still serious concerns. The Kiskatna River is the city's only water source, and water levels have been low. Right now, the city is working on a plan to transfer water overland temporarily by running a hose along the highway from the Peace River to Dawson Creek. Darcy Dober is the mayor. He talked to the CBC this morning about the plan and how the Kiskatna River has been looking this fall.
We had some, you know, some moisture, which helped a lot. So, but, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it was still, the Kiskatna's flow was at 15% of its average flow, so way below what it needs to be. But it helped get us through a spot this fall with the moisture to replenish our reservoirs and get us in a good position for what's, you know, likely going to come. But, you know, and then just with this cold weather, the last little bit, the flows of the Kiskatna are really started to slow down and it's starting to freeze in spots. So it's likely just a matter of time before we're unable to pump anymore from the Kiskatna.
Yeah, I was thinking about your community this morning as I wrote the weather forecast down today, temperature steady near -12, wind chills near -23. how quickly do you think you need the backup system with the hose system running into the piece?
Well, not like tomorrow. So we've applied for the permits to overland pump, and we got all that in process. Minister Green with that ministry has been phenomenal, and so is their staff and in helping us through that process. So we do have, because of past investments from the city and, other councils in the past, we have about 180 days of water in our reservoirs right now, and they're almost fully full. But once the Kiskatna freezes off, the problem is we can't solely rely on the reservoirs. Like, we can't run them dry. So it's likely, be sometime in the new year that we will likely start overland pumping just to keep the reservoirs full.
And remind us, if you would, how this works. So this pump runs about 50 kilometers along the highway from the Peace River to Dawson Creek. How does the overland pumping actually work?
I don't know the exact details, but from what I understand is it'll run from Taylor to Dawson Creek, come out of the Peace there. And then basically what will happen is it will just continuously pump us our daily use, because you can't really just pump, fill the reservoirs and shut them off. So it'll just produce our daily amounts, and then a little bit excess just to replenish the reservoirs at the same time.
How permanent a solution is this?
Well, this is just a short-term solution to help get us through, the winter and then spring. If we don't get a lot of moisture this winter, this could lead into spring and summer too, right? Because this is, 4 years of drought. It's something that doesn't get fixed overnight. Replenishing the Kiskatna, that is. But our long-term fix is to run a permanent line to the Peace. So that's another project we're also working on as well.
That was Dawson Creek Mayor Darcy Dober talking to the CBC's Carolina DeReich, the host of Daybreak North. It all began almost 15 years ago with an argument over access to tennis courts. It all ended days ago with a jury handing down a decision worth tens of millions of dollars. The players are two rich older men with properties at a luxury condo complex in Palm Beach, Florida. On one side is Ike Perlmutter, an Israeli-American billionaire, former CEO of Marvel Entertainment, and an unofficial advisor to Donald Trump. On the other is Harold Pirenboom, a self-made businessman originally from Thunder Bay, Ontario. In 2011, the Canadian filed a lawsuit claiming that access to the tennis courts was rigged. Soon found himself on the receiving end of a hate letter campaign accusing him of horrible crimes. He filed suit against the Marvel exec and his wife, who he blamed for the letters. What followed was more than a decade of legal battles, including accusations that Mr. Pirenboom had tried to steal DNA belonging to Mr. Perlmutter and his wife. Ultimately, a jury in a civil suit sided with the Perlmutters, ordering the Canadian businessman to pay over $50 million in damages. Alexandra Clow has covered the story for the Palm Beach Post since its very beginning. We reached her in Palm Beach, Florida.
Alexandra, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that as a reporter in Palm Beach covering feuds between the very wealthy may come with the territory, but does this story stand out as particularly bizarre?
Oh, I'd have to say so, definitely. I've been at the Palm Beach Post for more than 30 years, and often little problems blow up into big lawsuits. But in this case, given the amount of money involved by the people who are fighting each other, it's just really escalated into a years-long litigation with some of the most bizarre allegations.
As you know, this started with a complaint about access to the tennis courts there. Harold Pirenboom was the one making that complaint, but then he and others start getting strange mail. What were the accusations being made in those mailings, and who was getting them?
Exactly, yes. So he moved to the community called Sloan's Curve in Palm Beach. It's about 3 miles south of Mar-a-Lago on the ocean in 2010. And he began to take a close look at the management of the tennis center, didn't like the way it was being run, started to make inquiries, and soon after, people in the community began receiving mailings about him, and those mailings escalated to include allegations of murder, child sex abuse, and other crazy allegations, as well as insults. There were more than 1,000 mailings about him.
More than 1,000, very serious accusations. And is it true that it was, they were even sent to people who didn't know this couple at all?
That's right. They were sent to prisoners, including prisoners in Florida, as if from Mr. Perrin Boom, insulting the prisoners and daring them to come to his home in Palm Beach and confront him. So they were trying, these letters were trying to rile up people totally unconnected to Palm Beach or Mr. Perrin Boom whatsoever.
And then the couple ends up facing other accusations that they were trying to steal DNA. How does that come into the picture?
Right. So in 2013, Mr. Perrin Boom sued the Perlmutters, Ike and his wife, Laura Perlmutter, alleging that they were behind this letter writing campaign. And during the course of the lawsuit, they were invited to come into a lawyer's office and do what's called a deposition, which is basically answer some questions. And according to a lawsuit that Mr. Perlmutter filed against Mr. Perrin Boom, the Perlmutter's DNA was secretly taken from them when they touched water bottles or handled specially treated paper. Now, taking someone else's DNA without their knowledge or consent is a crime in the state of Florida. And so the Perlmutters filed a lawsuit against Harold Perrin Boom, claiming that their DNA had been stolen, that they had been defamed, that they had been wronged, and that this was part of a conspiracy.
And so if I'm putting the complicated pieces of this puzzle together, their allegation was that their DNA was taken without their knowledge or permission so that they could try to prove that the letters being sent were being sent by the Perlmutters. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And as part of the lawsuit, the Perlmutters say that their DNA was not linked, but Mr. Perrin Boom, knowing that, had their DNA manipulated to make it seem as if it were. And also, he shared publicly that they were linked to these letters. And the Perlmutters said that just wasn't the case.
And lawyers for the Perlmutters were arguing that others were behind the letters. Obviously, they're saying their clients are not to blame here. Who were they pointing the finger at?
Right. So they pointed the finger at a former employee of Mr. Perrin Boom, who lives in Canada, who allegedly was a disgruntled employee, as being the source of the hate mail campaign.
What do you think at the end of the day, when we talk about this jury's decision and this $50 million award to the Perlmutters, what do you think their legal team argued that convinced the jury that this was the decision that should come down?
I think they were successful in showing that there was no evidence that pointed to the Perlmutters as being the source of these hate mail letters, and that more importantly, the Perrin Boom team worked together in what they claimed was a conspiracy to try to attack the Perlmutters and damage their reputation. And ultimately, the one who was found to be most damaged was Laura Perlmutter, because it was her DNA that was alleged incorrectly to be on the letters. So the Perlmutters are, even though they live in Palm Beach, and even though Ike Perlmutter is the former chairman and CEO of Marvel Entertainment, they keep a low profile. They're very noted philanthropists. They give millions of dollars to healthcare institutions, educational institutions, and they really don't seek this kind of limelight. As for the rest of Palm Beach, everybody is very focused pretty much on the upcoming social season, planning for the next gala or the next ball, or what special events they should attend on their very busy calendar.
This is all sounding a lot like a certain Apple TV show right now. But if there were, I mean, I can imagine it being on Law and Order or an HBO series in the future. But do you think this $50 million decision from the court is really just a cliffhanger for what comes next?
The Perlmutters are seeking permission from the Florida Supreme Court to go after Mr. Perenboom for punitive damage. Those would be additional money damages above the $50 million mark. On the other hand, Perenboom's lawyer indicated that they are likely to appeal this $50 million judgment. So I don't think this case is over by a long shot.
Alexandra, I appreciate this. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Alexandra Clow is a staff writer with the Palm Beach Post. We reached her in Palm Beach, Florida. A few weeks ago, Wayne McKay was out for a hike on Meat Cove Mountain in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. He had a great view of nearby St. Paul Island, so he snapped a picture. And in the background, he saw what he believed to be Newfoundland, way off in the distance. He thought that was pretty cool, so he posted the photo to social media and ignited a fierce debate that eventually involved hundreds of people.
I was really surprised, first of all, that so many people shared it, and then that so many people adamantly disbelieved that it was Newfoundland in the picture, and then kind of the firestorm that resulted from that of almost a 50-50 split, I think, of people backing up what I think, or what I know, I should say, and then other people adamantly disagreeing and saying that there's no way that could be Newfoundland. There's been some debates around whether the Earth is flat or round as a result of the picture, which I think is kind of funny because obviously the Earth isn't flat. Seeing Newfoundland from Cape Breton doesn't prove the Earth is flat. Me thinking I see Newfoundland from Cape Breton doesn't make me a flat earther. What a lot of people are not thinking about is the altitude being factored in on both sides and how high up we were and how high up the mountains are on the other side in Newfoundland. Another thing that stood out to me was I have friends who are scientists who have PhDs in science and are very good at math, who laid out the math in the comments very clearly about the altitude on both sides and the distance and how that makes it in fact possible to see Cape Breton from Newfoundland and Newfoundland from Cape Breton, and people still don't agree. I was very happy to chat with some people from Newfoundland who actually are looking at us from the other side and have said they've been doing that for years from the tops of mountains over there, and that they can see St. Paul Island and Cape Breton Highlands on the other side. So it's kind of neat that we have that shared experience between people in Newfoundland and Cape Breton. We're a lot closer than we think sometimes.
Wayne McKay is an avid hiker in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.